It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening all week long. We have a lot to cover today. It's getting really exciting with so much going on in the election, as well as, you know what? There's a lot of football, too. I can't wait for this weekend. I can't believe the numbers of people watching. At a time in which it's hard to get anybody to watch one thing, no matter how big the show is, they're still coming to football and they're still coming to news, which is great for us. By the way, you could listen to the show every single day, every single way. You could watch on Fox Nation. You could watch on the Fox News app. You can see and hear live right there. Just click on the headsets. You'll see it on the app. Plus, you get the podcast on your favorite platform. And this is wherever you get the Brian Kilmeade Show, whatever you want to do. This hour, we're going to be joined by Admiral James Stavridis. And I just interviewed General Jack Keane. I'm going to bring that back. There's so much going on in the world right now. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
Reaction to Netanyahu rejecting a Palestinian state in a post-war scenario for Gaza?
I would just tell you that nothing's changed about President Biden's desire that a two-state solution is really in the best interest of not only the Israeli people, but of course, the Palestinian people.
Nice to say, Admiral Kirby, you don't live there. All eyes in the Middle East. We are attacking the Houthis daily. Israel is crushing Hamas and being pressured to stop. Why both have to continue with an eye on the cause of it all, and it's Iran.
Number two.
Like, I honestly have never spoken to as many people who are concerned about the migrant issue as I have over the past year. Working class people who I interact with every day until this past year really, really, really expressed their frustration.
That is Charlemagne the God. No escaping the effects of Biden's intentional broken border. The cities are rocked. Texas takes over its own border. Criminals running rampant as ICE is forced to look the other way. Will the Senate plan fix it all? Or not at all.
Number one.
All the polls show Trump with a pretty sizable lead among Republicans. So if Nikki Haley doesn't actually win the New Hampshire primary, that is the state that's probably one of the most favorable states for her on this primary map. And if she can't get a win there, that would be a huge Trump victory. And it would almost finalize Trump's role as the nominee going into South Carolina.
More than just the first primary, the New Hampshire showdown is shaping up to be a make or break for Nikki Haley. Why? Super Tuesday is 2 months away. I'll explain as Governor DeSantis holds out for South Carolina, but is not spending anything that we could see. He said, I'm going all in on Iowa, came in second. And then he said, I can't really do New Hampshire. I'll meet you in South Carolina. That's where he is. He'll go back and forth and he'll do some events. He was willing to debate, but Nikki Haley says, I'm only going to debate Biden or I'm only going to debate Trump. That's it. So he does every town hall and does every interview. But he's talking in a way in which he knows mistakes that he made, almost as if he thinks it's over. Here's Donald Trump last night, a very reflective Donald Trump. He was calm. He was concise, believe it or not, concise. And he's not talking about the past. Cut three.
What happened? You know, we get the most votes of any sitting president in history. And then somebody else takes over and they take a look at what we had versus what they have now. And the difference is so stark. It's so massive. It's so different. The country is a different place.
I mean, do you believe what he just said? We got more votes than any sitting president in history. Totally true. 74 million. And then somebody else takes over. He didn't say this thing was rigged. This thing was locked up. He cheated and did nothing. That's what people have been trying to say for the longest time. And the question is, does Donald Trump have a plan B? We know about his plan A. Got him first time, 74 million votes the second time. Had a rip-roaring 4 years. A lot of things went well, but the attacks never stopped. He made some mistakes, too. Obviously, we all do, but he made some mistakes in the line of fire, maybe caused the impeachment, knowing he had to play the perfect game. He didn't get close, and they used that as an opportunity to impeach, but he still worked his way through it. The pandemic was something we still can't get our head around. So he looks like he is on his way. If he wins in double digits in New Hampshire, you almost got to feel it is over. Nikki Haley not giving up. Cut six.
I think if he thinks I have no chance and I have no hope, then why is he running millions of dollars of ads against me? Do we really want to have two 80-year-olds running for president when we've got a country in disarray and a world on fire? I know that we've had some independents come our way. And yes, we've had some Democrats say they want to support us because they're not happy with Joe Biden.
There is, but they had to have registered in October to switch parties. And Joe Biden has totally abandoned New Hampshire, so they may have. They think there's about 4,000. Overall, undeclared in New Hampshire, 340,000. Pretty extraordinary considering the population's 1.4 million. With the last Suffolk poll, two Suffolk polls ago, it was a 7-point deficit. This Suffolk poll has Trump up 14. If he wins by 14, I'm not sure what happens in South Carolina. I mean, Trump won by 10 over Rubio in 2016. But since that time, he's gotten the sitting governor. He's extremely popular. He's gained popularity in South Carolina, very military time. So I don't think Nikki Haley wins there. And then you wonder if it continues. I know she's got a ton of money. But I also look at what Ken Langone said, one of the richest men in America, co-founder of Home Depot, 88 years old. He said, I think she's my pick, but I'm not going to throw money down a rabbit hole. I'm not going to burn it. If she doesn't win in New Hampshire, I'm not going to donate to her campaign. So kind of interesting. So here's Governor DeSantis yesterday. So listen, I still think he's a great candidate, unbelievable governor. I don't think he has a problem with the way he campaigns. That's just his style. You know, I don't have a problem. People might not think Nikki Haley talks too fast. They think that Donald Trump repeats himself. You can always find something. But Governor Ron DeSantis says he is he regrets. He did a few he made a couple of mistakes. Cut 11.
I spent a lot of time on the ground in Iowa, and it's good. And when you meet people, you convert them. But there's just so many voters out there that you got to do. And I came in not really doing as much media. I should have just been blanketing. I should have gone on all the corporate shows. I should have gone on everything. I started doing that as we got into the end of the summer, and we did it. But we had an opportunity, I think, to come out of the gate and do that and reach a much broader folks. Now I'm everywhere.
He is, and he's doing every town hall possible. And he does, you know, it's always great to admit mistakes. You know, that's a tactic. That's why you hire experienced people. You know, he was kind of walking through the fire, 60 Minutes and all his critics, and he was always successful. So he should not, his handler should have known that. But having said that, I think it's more the attack ads on him, about $40 million worth, maybe $50 million worth of attack ads. And most of it came from Donald Trump. And they went after him, and they were smart. That's a tactic Trump used. This guy's going to be a problem. I'm going to run the disloyalty thing. I'm going to say that, you know, he's trying to be taller, and then I'm just going to attack him. And that's what happened. And then when he finally declared, he was being attacked pretty consistently. We'll see. I don't know if anyone could beat Donald Trump, even though it's technically not over. My interview with General Jack Keane is so important. The Middle East is on fire. He puts it in perspective. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was detained at an airport in Munich, Germany the other day for more than 2 hours. Why? Because he failed to declare a watch reportedly valued at more than $20,000 upon his arrival. Has this ever happened to you? I've gone to an airport and they say, do you have anything to declare? And I always say, no, I don't. And most of the time, I really don't. So has this ever happened to you?
Oh, it happens all the time. You just got to learn to lie. And say,
first of
all, when you go to a foreign country, you have to spend the whole night before peeling off the Cuban cigar labels. And then when the guy looks you in the eye and says, Charles, are these Cubans? No, they're not. They're not Cuban. And then if you got a nice watch, no, I already had that watch. You have to lie.
Or you could just declare it.
No, you're going to pay taxes on it then.
Okay.
No, you're going to pay taxes on it. Trust me, we pay enough taxes, Gail.
So you're encouraging people to lie.
They do it all the time.
So that's a little of the exchange. Charles Barkley being Charles Barkley, and that's with Gail King on another channel. But it's true. I don't do a lot of international travel, But I didn't even understand the Schwarzenegger story. So he had a $10,000 watch, and he didn't declare it, and that's why they detained him? Were they trying to shake him down? Did they not know who he was in Munich?
Well, apparently it was like a $20,000 watch.
$20,000.
The reports he was possibly going to auction off, but you're supposed to declare that stuff, and you don't. But I guess no one ever does, but technically you're lying about it because you're supposed to pay whatever.
But only if
taxes.
You bought it there, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Eric, do you know? Do you do a lot of traveling? No.
I do not.
You do not? Okay. Because I would never think to do that. I mean, I went to Europe for the first time in a long time over this. I never thought about it, but I only have an Apple Watch. But Schwarzenegger got detained. He got a ton of publicity. I'm sure more people are going to buy his book. Do you know I've been trying to get Schwarzenegger, and they've been telling me, oh, you're going to get him. He wants to do it. And probably 5 of the last 7 weeks, yeah, he's going to do it.
Maybe tell him you have a really nice watch that he might be interested in.
Right. I mean, obviously. The other thing would be, you know, he's best friends with Jake Steinfeld. Jake Steinfeld was just on this week.
He was.
So, you know, him and Jake came into bodybuilding, but Arnold did steroids and Jake would not. So he did natural. There's no money in natural bodybuilding in the 70s when it was really hot. And he also, then he went into celebrity training, but they stayed friends and he headed up the fitness council. So I had to, now I asked, this is what I did. I said, Jake, can you do me a favor? Will you tell Arnold that I'm looking to interview him? So he goes, yeah, I'll get on that. So hopefully that'll break. Because remember, Arnold came and did our show all the time.
No, he's
remember
come on
he
all
surprised
the time.
Us in studio?
He did. But wait, so then Jake hasn't gotten back to you yet? Because he's a man of action. Like, I feel like he should
yeah,
have responded
I mean,
yet.
It was this week. I mean, it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And I told him, and, you know, he's somebody very persistent. So if he says, I'm coming on the 18th, he writes me on the 9th, he writes me the next day, writes me the next day. So I should be probably the same way to him. Don't you think?
I would agree. I think it's time to text Jake during the next break and say, when's Arnold coming on?
Okay. Meanwhile, earlier today, I have another job in the morning, Fox and Friends. One of my favorite segments all week long, every week, is my 7:15 a.m. interview with Jack Keane. It opens up with the president finally taking some questions about the Houthi rebels bombing. Listen.
Are the airstrikes in Yemen working?
Well, when you say working, are they stopping the Houthis? No. Are they going to continue? Yes.
Okay, here to react, Fox News senior strategic analyst, retired four-star General Jack Keane. General, we've been speaking that we had for the last few weeks. You got to answer the Houthi rebels. We are. Why don't you think they've been effective in clearing out the Red Sea and stopping the attacks?
Well, because the Houthi rebels have thousands of rockets and missiles and hundreds of launchers, and they've been at this for years in terms of fighting Saudi Arabia and initially UAE as well. So they're very practiced at war, and they're very skilled at what they're doing, and they have significant depth, much as Iran has supplied Hamas with all the components to make thousands and thousands of rockets and missiles, and have provided the Hezbollah with over 130,000 rockets and missiles. The Houthis have tens of thousands. So that's the reality we're facing. What we have to do is what the president is suggesting, and I agree with him. Let's keep it up. Let's sustain it. This is a finite number of rockets and missiles for sure, and a finite number of launchers. So step one is to continue the attacks that we're doing to take the capability away. Step two, and we're obviously doing this, and we have to be aggressive about it, is disrupt the flow of the replacement rockets, missiles, and other supplies from Iran to Yemen. All of that is going by sea, and we've got to intercept it, and we were doing that. And sadly, it looks like we may have lost a couple of SEALs in doing that very same thing. We got to be aggressive about it. And the third thing, Brian, and we've talked about this, the center of gravity behind all of this is Iran, and we have to hold them accountable, and we're not doing that. Maximum sanctions, step one. Take the money away from them that they've been able to receive as a result of this administration pulling back from the Trump sanctions. But then number two, the IRGC are the suppliers of the rockets, the missiles. They provide all the training and support for the Houthis. Go after their training centers, their bases, their headquarters, and their leaders. That is the third step that must be taken, and that is where the administration is reluctant to step in and do that.
Can we switch over to Israel and action in Gaza right now? We understand yesterday in an interview, Netanyahu rejected U.S. calls to scale back the military effort. And they said they accused the U.S. of trying to coerce Israel into a situation that would endanger their country. How bad is the friction between the countries and how is it affecting operations in Gaza?
Well, I think the tension has been rising over time. This is a very comprehensive and complicated operation that the IDF has been involved in. It's going to take months to be able to do what they're seeking to do, is dismantle the entire Hamas network and get the leaders and destroy their entire military infrastructure. That requires systematic, deliberate clearing operations. The administration has been pushing Prime Minister Netanyahu to pull back from those kind of clearing operations and just focus on the leaders. That will not get the IDF and the prime minister the results he wants. And what would happen as a result of that, the leaders will stay in place, the infrastructure will survive, thousands of fighters will survive also, Brian, and Hamas will declare victory, and they'll attack again. So that's where the tension point is. I think we should get out of the way and let the prime minister, his war cabinet, set the strategy and let the IDF execute it and continue to support them.
I'm just stunned by the sophistication of those tunnels, the underground networks that exist. I think it even surprised the Israelis how much weaponry was there and how deep these tunnels go. It's been fascinating because they're debriefing a lot of the captured Hamas fighters. General, always great. Thanks so much. The world's on edge, and there's nobody better to talk to about it. Appreciate it.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
You too.
Yeah, I mean, I could have talked to the general for 4 more hours and not covered all the hot spots. Think about this. We're hitting the Houthi rebels. We did not have great intelligence. We already talked the Saudis into not bombing them back, so they cut some type of deal with these tribesmen. I mean, did you see these guys? They got weapons, but they look like a ragtag group of knockoff Crips and Bloods. I mean, they're thugs. So they're rocketing us. They basically shut down the Red Sea. That's why you should care. Everything that you have is going to start going up again. That's why President Biden should care, because if he has inflation going up and prices going up and shipping's going up, we pay the price as a consumer. He's not getting reelected for sure. Now, we have a coordination with China, we have a coordination with Russia, we have a coordination with North Korea, and we have a coordination with Iran. And then ragtag groups like the Houthis, more sophisticated group like Hezbollah and Hamas. And then when the Russians going after the Ukrainians are fighting the Russians, that's why you back the Ukrainians. And North Korea and South Korea, North Korea building a ton of nukes, adding the technology from the Russians that they were not doing before. In exchange, they give the Russians artillery where they're bombing the Ukrainians. Do you see how it's all connected? Iran keeps us occupied by creating havoc in the area and maybe, possibly in a grand scheme, supporting and maybe conducting those horrific attacks on October 7th. So we're distracted back in the region. And who knows when China's going to make the move on Taiwan, especially, guys, if it looks as though Joe Biden's about to lose his election. And Pakistan, by the way, rocketed back at Iran for rocketing at them after that explosion on the anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. So things are the utter definition of near boiling point, exploding point. A lot going on. All right. So thanks so much for listening on this Friday and by listening to us all day, all week long. I appreciate it. We have a lot more to come, including in about 15 minutes. We'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Reaction to Netanyahu rejecting a Palestinian state in a post-war scenario for Gaza?
I would just tell you that nothing's changed about President Biden's desire that a two-state solution is really in the best interest of not only the Israeli people, but of course, the Palestinian people. In fact, it's the best interest of the region. And we're not going to stop working towards that goal. This is not a new comment by Prime Minister Netanyahu. We obviously see it differently.
Yeah, they see it a lot differently. On Thursday, there was a major speech by the prime minister where he basically told America, stop telling us how to run this war. And he doesn't want a Palestinian state in Gaza. I have not heard, it's the most complicated question maybe in the world, but I have not heard a scenario that if I'm an Israeli that I feel good about that allows the Palestinian Authority to take over the Gaza. Really? Mahmoud Abbas? He's got 15% approval rating in the West Bank. He's going to bring some of that momentum to Gaza. Admiral James Stavridis joins us now. He knows all about difficult questions. He writes about it. He's got a book, Risk It All Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. He wrote that book. He also got a new book coming out. The book that a lot of people are talking about is 2034, a novel of the next world war, which basically looks like he had a meeting with Nostradamus. Admiral, welcome back.
Great to be back, Brian. Good intro. Thank you.
So, Admiral, I'm going to give you the most complicated question right now in the world. What does happen when the military operation ceases in Gaza?
Yeah, I can answer that with three words, Brian. I don't know, and neither does anybody else, including Nostradamus. But I'll give you a couple scenarios. One you alluded to that I think is dead on arrival, and that is the Palestinian Authority. They don't have the competence, the moral standing, the international standing. Another one, more realistic, I think, would be for the Arab League. This is the group of Arab nations, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Egypt, Jordan, et cetera. There's a lot of capability there. You could turn it over to them in a joint Arab League-Israeli operation. That's very hard optically for the Arabs to agree with. You could also, third possibility, you could set up a United Nations peacekeeping force. A lot of people have visceral negative reaction to the United Nations with good reason, but they've done reasonably good work, for example, in Haiti, in the Balkans, and in other places. So there's three possibilities, but we are nowhere yet on getting that done realistically. And I want to close with this, Brian. You made the right point. It has to be a solution that allows the Israelis to be safe, that their nurseries won't be stormed into, that their women will not be raped and dragged away by their hair as hostages. That's going to require, I think, a significant Israeli presence, certainly surrounding Gaza, but probably integrated with the security forces inside it.
Yeah, I just don't know. Also, if Netanyahu's losing his patience, too, and how you feel about it with basically Jake Sullivan and others telling him how to run the war and tell him when to stop. And President Biden, evidently, in December, hung up on each other. He hung up on Netanyahu when he was trying to say you got to scale back. And basically Netanyahu said no. So a lot of this stuff is not being walked back or being told where it's overblown. But we are supplying a lot of the arms. So we do have a say in this. But I personally side with Netanyahu. Let him finish the job. And the network of tunnels is even more concerning than they thought going in.
100% correct. Just to put it in numbers people can comprehend, the Gaza Strip is about 20 miles north-south, and it's about 5 miles or so east-west. There are, wait for it, not 200 miles of tunnels. That's what we thought 3 months ago. Apparently, there are 400 miles of tunnels. So I think job one, militarily, the center of gravity here for the Israelis, is to decommission those tunnels, to flood them, to explode them, to collapse them. That's where all of this planning occurred. That's where the training happened. That's where Iran sent the weapon systems that were used. That's where the command and control is located. All of that. That's got to finish. And I think Netanyahu is doing that. And frankly, despite his public utterances, I think it is significant that Israel is dialing back, and it makes sense militarily. I'll leave the politics to others, Brian, but militarily, if I were running that campaign, I would be dialing back, not only because of the public optics and all of that, but also because I'm getting more worried about my northern border and Hezbollah. So I don't want to have all my eggs in that basket in Gaza. I think for those two reasons, you're seeing the Israelis kind of dial it back. Hopefully they will continue to prosecute this war. I think they will.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, what success do you think they've had in wiping out Hamas fighters?
I think they've taken out probably a third of Hamas's foot soldiers. I think they've taken out, by my count, and I've got a chart where I kind of track all this, I think they've taken out about 20% of Hamas leadership defined as somebody who is controlling a significant element of that organization. Those are pretty good numbers 2 months into urban conflict. If I put all that together, I think we've got another 2 months of very tough fighting. That'll take Hamas's foot soldiers down to, I don't want to say negligible, but they'll have dispersed back into the population. They won't be a fighting force anymore. They will also get, the Israelis will also get a significantly additional number of the leadership. Look for about another 2 months of very tough fighting in Gaza.
All right, so we're dealing with the Red Sea and the Houthis' attack on us and our assets. So why don't you hear President Biden was asked about how it's going. The audio's not great, but I think you can hear it well enough to understand what the question is and the answer. Cut 32.
Are the airstrikes in Yemen working?
Well, when you say working, are they stopping the Houthis? No. Are they going to continue? Yes.
All right, having said that, how would you? Thanks.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
That's obviously just a terrible soundbite for the president. And here's what the president meant to say in the judgment of Admiral Stavridis. What he should have said was, thus far, the strikes have not created deterrence in the minds of the Houthis. However, we have destroyed about 25% of their infrastructure. We're going to continue going until it is all destroyed if necessary, but we'd prefer to stop and then to be deterred. Thus far, that hasn't happened. You know, that's a logical, coherent explanation of what's happening. That would have been a better answer for the president, in my view.
I think in my view, too. But that's what happens when you work the rope line, you're not going back and forth. Now, let me ask you, how is our intelligence on the Houthis and their assets prior to them targeting ships in the Red Sea?
Pretty good, mainly because two of our strong allies in the region, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been pounding away at the Houthis for close to 5 years. What has happened since the Houthis started attacking American warships and commercial shipping is that the unblinking eye, if you will, of U.S. intelligence is now focused on that Red Sea border. And I think our intelligence is quite good at this point. We can go in and do what we need to do. I think the Houthis may bluster and they may launch a few more missiles. But if we just continue to methodically destroy their radars, their fuel, their docks, their missile sites, their ammunition storage, we know where all that is. If we just continue to pound that away, they can bluster all they want, but they can't do much.
How fascinating is it that Soleimani, they were marking 4 years since his death, and then there's an explosion. Israel had nothing to do with it. So now Iran starts to target Pakistan, and Pakistan hits Iran back. What do we do? Just look up in the sky and just watch this? Are we hoping they both lose?
I think in this one, both sides are demonstrating they don't have a lot of options. They don't get along very well, shall we say. The reason they have struck across each other's borders, not to go after the opposite government, but to go after rebels to each side that are across that border. I don't think you're going to see a lot more between them. But here's what we ought to be concerned about. You know this, Brian, not everyone does. Pakistan is a well-armed nuclear state with, shall we say, a government that is in turmoil a great deal of the time. We really don't want to see nuclear power on one side come into this. We don't have a role in it, but frankly, I'm for it in the sense that anything that distracts the mullahs from what they're trying to do with the Houthis and Hamas and Hezbollah, that's a good thing for the region overall.
Yeah, I guess so. We'll see. Are you concerned about this new alliance between North Korea and Russia? Russia reportedly is giving high-tech intelligence to high-tech information and technology on their nuclear program in exchange for artillery?
100% concerning. And here's why. You know, it's like that old movie, Jerry Maguire, you know, you complete me. They kind of complete each other, and that Putin is running out of conventional dumb bombs, artillery pieces, the equivalent of 155 millimeter shells, ammunition, crew-served weapons. That's the junk that he needs. Pyongyang, North Korea, has tons of that. They've been doing nothing but building it for 50 years. On the other hand, what North Korea needs, exactly as you said, you mentioned nuclear power, nuclear weapons, missile technology. One thing you didn't mention is space and satellite technology. That's what's flowing in the other direction. It is a pair of scorpions in a bottle. These are two pariah nations. They are going to help each other, and that is not good for the international system.
It isn't. The Ukraine war, how bad do they need weapons at this point? Are they at the point of desperation, Ukrainians?
Not quite desperation, but deep worry. And here, of course, the scene of the battle effectively is shifting from Kyiv and Moscow. You know this, Brian. It's in Washington, D.C. And I am urging our congressional leaders to put aside partisan advantage and don't be thinking about who will look better and how the fall election comes out. Ukrainians are fighting and dying now, and we ought to continue to support them. As you and I have discussed many, many times, this is not a huge amount of money. And by the way, I'm all for tying it to border security. These are two national security concerns alongside Israel and Taiwan. This is really a chance for Congress to step up, override the small minority who oppose this. And there are many powerful Republicans and powerful Democrats who could stand in unity on this. Boy, let's hope so. The right decision is to provide that funding both for border security and for Ukraine.
If we allow Kyiv to fall, the Republicans will be more responsible than Democrats. And there's some might, like when you talk about the way we fight, the slow walking of weapons, the giving weapon systems late, all that stuff is true. That'll be just as bad as Kabul falling and maybe more consequential.
That is absolutely correct. And I think, let's face it, Afghanistan is a small, backward, poverty-stricken nation, kind of in the middle of nowhere. Ukraine is a huge country full of corn, wheat, oil, natural gas. It's a cornucopia of resources. It's parked right on the edge of the European Union. If we allow Ukraine to fall under the boot of Russia, we ought to become very concerned about Putin's next move. We ought to be smart enough to nip this one in the bud.
The next one will be Moldova is not, but I'm sure the next one will be a NATO nation. Then we're going to have to really make a decision. Thanks so much, Admiral. Appreciate it. And hopefully they wise up in Congress and give the Ukrainians what they need to win.
You bet. Let's from your lips to God's ears. Okay, Brian, we'll talk next week.
And
talk
I look soon. Forward to your book, March 12th, 2054, a novel. Thanks so much, Admiral. See you soon. Back with your calls in a moment. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm here to tell you that the Western world is in danger. And it is endangered because those who are supposed to have to defend the values of the West are co-opted by a vision of the world that inexorably leads to socialism and thereby to poverty.
So how fascinating is this? This Argentinian president, who seems to be a version of President Trump, and he's a fan of President Trump, Javier Milei, was speaking at the World Economic Forum and saying things that they're not really in support of. They're all about green technology and sharing the wealth and developing nations. And he says, we got to get back to capitalist principles and think about our country and our people first. This very much sounds like President Trump, and I think he's going to be an ally of it. Also, on the same note, I was reading about, I can't give you the latest on French politics. Never could. Not that interested. But we know Macron's been around forever and came up as a radical, transformational, non-traditional party candidate and then won. Then he won again. Well, now he's talking about just being more conservative, going back to French values, back to France first, and thinking about cracking down on citizenship, illegal aliens. And do you know what the British are doing? They're taking illegal immigrants and shipping them to Rwanda. So for those people who think that cracking down on the on your border is something that you shouldn't do and is barbaric and it goes against what's on our Statue of Liberty, number one, I think you're 100% wrong. I believe you're changing. So are the other countries changing. They're protecting their border. Talk about immigration. Here's Charlemagne the God. Big liberal, disappointed in Biden, not a fan of Trump, but listen to this. Cut 21.
Like, I honestly have never spoken to as many people who are concerned about the migrant issue as I have, you know, over the past year. They took 2,000 migrants and put them in the school and made the school stay home, made the students stay home and do school via Zoom. And that was a big issue. I've never seen, you know, working class people who I interact with every day until this past year really, really, really expressed their frustration.
You see how hot this issue is? They did a survey in Iowa and they said, what was your number one issue? And it wasn't even the economy. It was immigration first. And yet you have Democrats tone deaf like Max Frost, cut 22.
Don't welcome immigrants if you plan to reject them. If you keep pushing your bigoted HR 2 bill, then also pass this bill. I've taken the liberty of drafting it for you. It removes the Statue of Liberty, our largest symbol that tells people to come here.
You believe this? He actually equates millions of illegal immigrants storming our border, giving the stiff arm to our system, to people who came here the right way through Ellis Island from a gift after the Civil War from France. But that, okay, Max Frost, best of luck in Florida. Good luck winning re-election. Keep it here. Don't forget, BrianKilmeade.com, a chance to order Teddy and Booker T and get it signed, personalized.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Brian Kilmeade here from 48th and 6th. I'm so glad you are listening. We come to you from New York, but heard around the country. Jared Renshaw is standing by, White House reporter for Reuters. His fascinating look at one of the topics I'd like to talk about is this big push to stop a third party like No Labels from getting on every ballot, like RFK from getting on every state ballot, and to stop them. Why? Because it's generally thought that it would hurt Joe Biden more than any Republican candidate, let alone Donald Trump. Bottom of the hour, Julie Banderas states for the whole half hour. That'll be great. So we're going to talk to him in a moment, but let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Reaction to Netanyahu rejecting a Palestinian state in a post-war scenario for Gaza?
I would just tell you that nothing's changed about President Biden's desire that a two-state solution is really in the best interest of not only the Israeli people, but of course, the Palestinian people.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen. All eyes on the Middle East as we are attacking the Houthis daily. Israel is crushing Hamas and being pressured by us to stop. Why both have to continue with an eye on the cause of it all, and that is Iran.
Number two.
Like, I honestly have never spoken to as many people who are concerned about the migrant issue as I have over the past year. Working class people who I interact with every day until this past year really, really, really expressed their frustration.
Charlemagne the God weighing in. No escaping the effects of Biden's intentional broken border. Cities are rocked. Texas takes over their own border security. And criminals running rampant as ICE is forced to look the other way. Will the Senate plan fix it at all or not at all?
Number one.
All the polls show Trump with a pretty sizable lead among Republicans. So if Nikki Haley doesn't actually win the New Hampshire primary, that is the state that's probably one of the most favorable states for her on this primary map. And if she can't get a win there, that would be a huge Trump victory and would almost finalize Trump's role as the nominee going into South Carolina.
More than just the first primary, the New Hampshire showdown is shaping up to be a make or break for Nikki Haley. Why? Super Tuesday is 2 months away. And yet it will be over in New Hampshire. I'll explain as DeSantis holds on while not spending any money on ads. Let's talk about the election from a different perspective now. Let's bring in Jared Renshaw, the White House reporter for Reuters. Jared, welcome.
Hey, well, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Well, I know Joe Lieberman, who's co-founder of No Labels, spoke yesterday just to complain and said they're filing an official complaint. How hard are Democrats working behind the scenes to stop No Labels?
I would say very hard. You know, they view this as any vote for No Labels is a vote away from a potential vote away from Joe Biden. They see Trump's base is extremely loyal. He may have a lower ceiling, but, you know, there's 30-40% are going to stick with him no matter what. And, you know, the Biden's enthusiasm gap, they could certainly divide the moderate base of the Democratic Party and really kind of hand the election to Trump is the way the theory goes.
Right. And they really are going after him hard. Here's the allegation from Dan Webb. He's asking the DOJ to investigate. Listen.
We have set forth substantial evidence and alleged that based on that evidence, there is a group of activists and operatives and party officials who have participated in alleged illegal conspiracy to use intimidation, harassment, and fear against representatives of No Labels, its donors, and its potential candidates.
So they're asking Joe Biden's Department of Justice?
They are. You know, they filed an 8-page complaint out detailing a bunch of allegations. You know, largely it's been a persuasion campaign telling donors not to send money to these third-party bids, trying to tell candidates to stay away from them. And then I think most importantly, keeping them off state ballots. State ballots are incredibly hard to get on, and they're technical, and you make one flaw, you find yourself in court. And so they've hired some big gun election lawyers to kind of, I think the quote in our story was, dot every I, cross every T.
Mark Elias is working this for Democrats. This guy's at the helm of all controversial Democratic projects, including the Russia hoax.
Yeah, the American Bridge, the largest Democratic opposition research firm, has hired Mark Elias. And, you know, they're going to try to create headaches for these third parties as they try to get on state ballots. And there's already enough headaches for these folks already. California, New York has high signature requirements and short time windows. You have to get electors lined up. Sometimes you have to name your vice president. Every state's different, and every state comes with its own kind of potential pitfall where you could find yourself in court defending yourself. And I expect a lot of lawsuits.
So, like, for example, you point out in California, to qualify, an organization must collect 75,000 signatures from residents who are willing to switch parties or register for the first time. An independent candidate must collect 219,000 signatures, the most of any state over a 105-day stretch that starts in April. So,
yeah, that's an enormous challenge. If you look at the minor party, the 75,000, I mean, you have to get people to sit willing to essentially register for a new party, a party that they're unfamiliar with. And 75,000 of those in a short time window. That's challenging. If you look at the independent candidate, 200, whatever that number was, it's a large number. And you have to hire people to go and collect signatures. Often, as you could imagine, you know, people who think they're registered voters are not. So they get tossed. So it's not just that number. I think the number is 25% to 50% more because of all the signatures that are going to get tossed legitimately, because they're not registered voters. New York, you have to do something like, I think it's like 65,000 in a five-week window. You have to get 50% of all the congressional districts at some signatures in all those districts. So It is a hard hill to climb. And then once you climb it, here come potential legal challenges saying, well, this person said they lived in Manhattan, not New York City. Well, Manhattan's not really an official city, so therefore they get tossed. So there's going to be a lot of that. I think the third parties understand it's coming. They have money. They have raised money, and I think these are the most well-organized, well-funded third-party bids probably in modern political history. So they'll have money to fight it. So I do think that's an underreported story in terms of just the
Absolutely.
Third parties and success that they may have.
No, Jared, you're right. I mean, I'm looking at you have Arizona, 43,000 signatures to qualify. You got to do that in 90 days. A minor party requires fewer signatures, but they must be submitted the whole year prior to the election. So that's why RFK is on one ballot, Utah, right?
Yes, he's on Utah, and I think he's in six other states. He's going to have a challenge getting them. He has a super PAC that is helping his efforts. That there's going to be some legal questions of whether a super PAC can actually help a candidate. They're not supposed to coordinate, so how he's getting them. The super PAC is going to get them on the ballot. Of course, that looks like coordination. That is going to probably be litigated. I think that, not only do you have to successfully get these, you're going to have a legal strategy to handle all the incoming that they will inevitably see.
Jared, how did Russ Perot pull it off?
It's a good question. He got on all 50 ballots. He had money. It really does take resources. You talk to folks on the ground, people that have tried to run third-party campaigns, and they talk about paying workers who only get 8 signatures, and it's hard to verify whether how hard they're working. If you have money to burn, which Ross Perot did, it makes life easier on that front. So I think that explained it. But you look at Ralph Nader, another person who's often cited as a third. He didn't get on all 50 ballots in either 2000 or 2004. Yeah, it's a challenge. You need money. The bottom line, like in most things in life, you need money. Right. If you have money, you can do it.
Right. I guess No Labels has money, but they're frustrated enough to say we need a lawsuit. So Joe Manchin told me on Friday, it was on Tuesday. He said, if I get on 34 states right after Super Tuesday, if they get on 34 ballots, my sense is he's in. But right now they're only on how many? 7 No Labels?
They're on 14, I think.
14.
13 or 14, and they're in 13 or 14 other states. I forget which. It's one or the other. But they're in 27 states altogether with. I think they're on the ballot in 14 of those. So the problem they have is an odd one, right? So a lot of states require you to name your presidential candidate before you can get on the ballot. They don't have a candidate. So there's a number of states that they have to have a president and a vice president named. I don't know what that number is, but it's a significant number. So they can't even start collecting signatures in a large group of states until they actually have a candidate.
Why should they be held to a different standard than the major parties?
That's a question. I mean, the major parties, they control the state legislatures. They make the rules. They dictate the rules of the game. And I think there's a fair rule that if you've shown some electoral success, meaning you have a history of getting votes during major elections, you automatically qualify. And that strikes me as a fair way to do it. I think it's debatable whether you have these very restrictive policies to keep them off. But if you already demonstrated some success, I think it's fair that you get back on. And that's a system we inherit. I do think it's important to note that you look across the world. A lot of other countries, a lot of major democracies have a much different style where they welcome third parties, coalition style governments that, where you have a coalition right. that cobbles together 15 minor parties and forms mm-hmm. a coalition. We don't have that.
So Dean Phillips is running for the Democratic nomination, been frustrated every pass. It's hardly a Democratic may the best man win approach. Listen to his frustration.
This is not just not supporting competition. This is literally actively trying to suppress it. I'll give you 3 examples. The state of North Carolina and the state of Florida. The Democratic Party in each state decided there would only be one candidate on the ballot, and therefore we will not have a presidential primary. Essentially disenfranchising.
On what grounds?
None. In fact, I'll give you another example. North Carolina 2020, 15 Democrats on the ballot. The only qualifier to be on the North Carolina ballot in their law is to be recognized in the national media as a candidate for president. And Marianne Williamson was on the ballot in 2020, along with 14 other Democrats. This year, the North Carolina Democratic Party only offered the name of Joe Biden to be on the ballot to the Secretary of State.
So you interviewed him. Obviously, he's a self-made multimillionaire, if not a billionaire. He voted with Biden 95% of the time, but he thinks he's too old and is likely to lose. And you can hear his frustration. Does that sound fair to you?
Certainly not fair. He doesn't think it's fair. You know, the DNC has made it nearly impossible. Not want to say impossible. Very challenging for Dean Phillips to have any real success. You know, New Hampshire, who knows what that looks like. Even if Dean Phillips was able to pull off some surprise, maybe not win, get close. The next state is South Carolina. He has no chance in South Carolina. Biden's going to spend all of his time there. He's got a good base. The large majority of Democratic voters in South Carolina are black. So, you know, Dean Phillips is – so what is he – he doesn't know anywhere to go after that. And then, as you stated in those clips, there's some states where he can't even get – there is no contest. So, yeah, I mean, he has a point to be made, you know, and that is his major point. Just, you know, that America is starving, or Democratic Party is unhappy with its candidate, and the polls show the candidate is likely to lose at this point. And he believes by shutting down competition, you're really essentially handing the election to Donald Trump. That is his central argument.
Right. And I see in your article, he said that when Trump was elected, his daughters were crying, and I promised I would do something about it, and I'm going to do it. And he thinks that Biden's going to lose this time. I'll tell you what, if you just look at the Democratic Party, what they've done to each other. I mean, Hillary Clinton got the questions from Donna Brazile before a debate with Bernie Sanders. Debbie Wasserman Schultz working behind the scenes to hurt Bernie Sanders. Joe Biden picked out of obscurity by Jim Clyburn after it looked as though Bernie Sanders was going to come away with the nomination, perhaps. So they just basically place him there to get the nomination instead of just watching the delegates go back and forth like Hillary Clinton, Obama did. So little by little, they're rigging their own game.
Well, certainly, you know, the argument that the Biden and the DNC has made for moving South Carolina to the front of the line, there's no coincidence that it also is Biden's probably one of his strongest states. And you know, the argument was that South Carolina is more diverse. It is certainly more diverse than New Hampshire and Ohio. Certainly black voters are an important part of the Democratic coalition. But it's also true that any real competition would have to go through South Carolina first. And that was not a mistake. So, you know, you can certainly see it through both lens. And, you know, to the victor go the spoils, I guess, is one way to look at it. He runs the DNC, and they get to set up the way this works, and they set it up in a way that best advantages the incumbent. There's just no way, other way to see it.
Wow. There's a lot going on here behind the scenes that has nothing to do with Republicans. It's just a lot of drama. I didn't hear no labels. Did they call out the Republican Party, too?
No, they expect, whose name escapes me, the North Carolina, former North Carolina governor, and I've talked to other Republicans. The general thought is that Republicans right now are, you know, obviously in a primary. They're not organized behind one candidate.
Yeah.
Once they do, I think we'll start seeing maybe some concerns from them. You remember, there are states that Republicans hope to win, are likely to win, and not every state is it hurt Biden. You know, there's a lot of red states where a no-labels candidate could hurt Donald Trump. So, you know, one of the interesting things to watch for is whether there's this kind of selective litigation where, you know, Biden's not going to care. He's not going to litigate Alabama, right? So his the Mark Eliases of the world are not going to be totally worried about those states.
Right, I understand.
But the Republican side may. Mm. So you may see some selective litigation in states where they think they may be most hurt. So that's a kind of a good way to see where they're, you know, where they think they have some trouble is where they actually litigate.
Jared, it's a great topic, man. Great work. I really appreciate it and telling our audience about it. Jared Renshaw, appreciate it. White House reporter for Reuters.
No problem.
Have a great weekend, Jared.
All right, bye-bye.
1-866-408-7669. I'm going to come back and take your calls. Bottom of the hour, Julie Banderas. Then all bets are off.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think if he thinks I have no chance and I have no hope, then why is he running millions of dollars of ads against me? Do we really want to have two 80-year-olds running for president when we've got a country in disarray and a world on fire? I know that we've had some independents come our way. And yes, we've had some Democrats say they want to support us because they're not happy with Joe Biden.
So Nikki Haley not giving up at all. She's very confident. You know, one thing about her, you watch her in the smallest interview or the biggest town hall. Very confident and not scared and warm, but tough. And I remember reading her book and thinking to myself, she's doing an incredible job at the UN. She was, by the way, she was almost impossible to book to. She'd be in New York City across town. We have to get her in here. We watched her fiery speeches. We saw she was one of the few, unlike Rex Tillerson, that understood the president and how to work with him. And he would say, listen, I'm going to go blast China. She'd say, I'm going to go blast China today. You know, I'm going to go blast Rocket Man today. And then when it was time to back off and the president said, I'm going to set up a meeting and just try to de-escalate this situation, she backed off. But when she was done after 2.5 years, I thought she was going to finish the four. She got the White House meeting because the president had that much respect for the job she did. And when she took the job as governor of South Carolina, she said, I'll only take the job if I can report directly to you. That means they know each other well. And that bothered, by the way, the Secretary of State, too, at the time.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I also want to mention Congressman Deborah Ross. Where's Deborah? I just had my picture taken with her. That's probably why she left. No, all kidding aside. Anyway, she couldn't be here, actually. That's not true. I got it mixed up. And she has, she fights very hard for the people's district, and she's up in Washington right now.
So Deborah is the congresswoman that represented the district. He spoke in yesterday in North Carolina, Julie Banderas. And he said, I just took a picture with her. Deborah. Who's it? And then he goes, Deborah's not even here. So again, totally clueless. I mean, everyone makes mistakes. We do public speaking all the time. But this is nonstop with this guy. This is the president of the United States. He doesn't know who he took a picture with in the district that he's actually appearing in.
I actually, to make it worse, I thought he was referring to the vice president and forgot who Kamala was.
Oh, no,
I was
no.
Like, wait, is he talking about Kamala Harris? Yeah, no, she's your VP. Remember you picked her because she's a minority? But no, I mean, that doesn't surprise me. He doesn't know names. You're not supposed to expect to know names when you're the president of the United States. I mean, the poor guy should just never speak in public. That's what
yeah,
I think.
He really does.
Unless he has a teleprompter. And that's why he never really does speak. They don't want him to speak because they know that he's going to do stuff like this.
You know, it was in print, and I think you read it too. His former chief of staff came out. She's now on MSNBC and said to the handlers, by the way, which shows, do you notice that they talk to him through the media? Because evidently he must be impossible to get a hold of. So you are Axelrod making his statements, Carville making his statements. Obviously, they could have handled that privately,
right?
That your campaign is backwards. You have the wrong message. Bidenomics doesn't work. They're doing it publicly because they can't get through. So this woman comes out and she says, you have to let Joe Biden be Joe Biden. He's great one-on-one with people, working the rope line, speaking extemporaneously in town halls. And I'm thinking to myself, well, no.
No.
That would be a disaster, but you might not have a choice. Are you just going to try to run reelect with surrogates? Well, Pritzker and Gavin Newsom, Waltz
of
Minnesota.
The inter-office fighting going on in that White House, if I could be a fly on the wall, seriously, if you imagine. First of all, there's all these different directives when it comes to Bidenomics, for example, which that wasn't even a term he came up with. Somebody else came up with it.
It was the Wall Street Journal.
And he went with it for a while. Then they realized, wait a second, this makes no sense.
40 million later to sell Bidenomics.
Our economy sucks. Why are we why are we promoting Bidenomics when really there is no Bidenomics? It's Biden failure. So, I mean, and that is a campaign message that I think they were going to run with, and now they're not. They don't have their ducks in a row. I don't think Biden, nobody, if they do give Biden any advice, he certainly doesn't take it because they have mixed messaging coming out of the White House. That's the worst way to run an administration.
And I think you have an example, too, of a guy that they don't want speaking because, number one, people, for example, after the Taiwan elections, this was a victory for democracy. But it is scary because it means China is more likely to invade. So do you believe in Taiwan independence? No. Now, what does that mean? For the average person who doesn't understand the nuances of this territory of China that has its independence that was hatched in 1940. So why not you just take a second, use this opportunity to say, I'm not for an independence, but I love that democracy worked. Europe put out a benign message. There was everyone saying this shows it worked. Congressional leaders, speaker on down, it shows it worked. And we stand with the democracy and free Taiwan. We got it. Understood. Never wants to say anything. Then when he's asked yesterday about the Houthi rebels, and says, you know, what about them? Are they designated a terrorist state? Last week he says yes. And then this week he's asked, are the strikes on Houthi rebels working? Here they are.
Are the airstrikes in Yemen working?
Well, when you say working, are they stopping the Houthis? No. Are they going to continue? Yes.
Thanks. Well, what do you do?
That's real reconcerning. I mean, you don't even know what's happening overseas. Who is making the call? Who is the commander in chief? Because I don't think it's President Biden, to be perfectly honest with me. I mean, his military generals are obviously keeping him abreast of the situation. And the fact that he made the call. He basically was the one that finally gave them the go ahead that, yes, let's go after the Houthis, who've been, by the way, for months, hundreds of attacks on U.S. soldiers and on ships going through shipping channels. And they've been getting away for years. Iran's been getting away with it for years. And so he finally pulled the trigger and he figures, oh, I did my part. I gave them the go ahead. But I don't think he's doing any follow up. He needs to actually know if it's working. And if it's not working, then why aren't we doing more?
Or you say, so far, the attacks have continued, which means we're going to ratchet up our attacks.
Right.
And let them know it's only going to get worse for you. Here's Nikki Haley, how she would answer the question. Cut 36.
And so now that they have started causing trouble there, you know, what we're seeing Biden do is now he's like, uh-oh, we're going to go put the terrorist designation back on them. And now even if he put the sanctions back on Iran, it's going to take a while to do that. And so our goal should always be, how do you prevent war? That's the number one thing. How do you prevent war? And the best way you prevent war is to deter it in the first place. That doesn't mean putting your head in the sand. It actually means showing strength. So when Iran started shooting at our men and women in Iraq and Syria, why did it take 130 times for Biden to do something about it?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And by the way, there are a lot of officials, military officials, that will say that going after Iran proxies isn't enough. And I'm not saying that we need to declare war against Iran, but we definitely need to put more pressure on Iran. And as far as giving Iran those billions of dollars so that they can turn around that sanctioned money that we just gave back to Iran for them to go around, turn around and buy more weapons to attack U.S. soldiers, and they're not considered a terrorist network? What the hell? How is it that the Houthis are not in the terrorist network and regime? What? Do something about that. Not that it would make any difference.
Yeah, by doing that, as you know, you enter into the White House in 2021. First week, Anthony Blinken changes it in order to let Iran know, I want to be friends.
We mean,
I want to get back
exactly.
to the
exactly. You got to show Iran we mean business. But Biden doesn't mean business in any way, shape,
or
form.
And then you went to Saudi Arabia and said, you're a pariah nation. Go, really? They've been rocketing us. You take them off the terror list.
Yep.
And we're a pariah nation.
Right.
So now Saudi Arabia goes, hey, I just settled things down with them. You told me to. Now, they were telling us, don't rocket the Houthis because it's going to start rocketing us again.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally have no choice through it. So this is a huge mess. But what's very interesting, I don't buy into the Republican argument in some circles that we should not be involved. I believe that we have to back up Israel. I think that if we're going to keep those shipping lanes open, we have to do it. Now, I know they're playing us. They want us distracted. But it still doesn't stop us from being responsible. Like, there is a section of the Republican Party that does not like that answer from Nikki Haley. I do.
No, I think we need to be stronger. I mean, and you know, the rest of the world, the Arab world, the Muslim world, they don't like the fact that the United States is backing Israel. Israel has every right in the world to defend itself, and that's exactly what it's doing. So they're not committing genocide. It was Hamas that committed genocide. And as far as all these other terrorist groups getting involved with Hezbollah attacking Israel from the north, now you got the Houthis from Yemen. I mean, it's a disaster. And Iran is behind all of it. And what has the United States done? Absolutely nothing. We get called called out for backing Israel. What we should be doing is going after Iran. And Iran proxies and their hand in terror, not only in Yemen, but in Iraq. I mean, we've been getting they've been getting attacked there. They're behind the war. They're you know, helping fund the war between Russia and Ukraine. When is somebody going to hold Iran accountable? And by hold them accountable, I mean have the kahunas. I'd like to say another word. It rhymes with malls. To actually stand up
maybe
to Iran. I know
time.
You don't. Maybe in the commercial I'll spell it out for you.
So the other big story, which has really become a 50-state story, is what's happening at the border. And I'm amazed. I don't know what kind of deal is going to be struck, what's going to be submitted.
Yeah.
By the way, what are you going to be on today?
Oh, I'm going to be on Outnumbered. So, you know, I've got plenty of time. I'll just take over the rest of your show.
Right. So you could be on for another hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, no, totally. All right. Can totally go on TV looking the way I do with a roller in my head. Yeah.
Wait, is that a roller?
It is.
I thought that was not a natural
bump. No, you thought I bumped my head, didn't you?
Right.
No, I didn't. I may speak like I do, but no, that's a roller.
Do you a lot of head balls as a kid?
I love head balls.
Right.
There you go, saying the word. Thank you, Brian.
But that's the word.
I knew I'd get it out of him. Yeah, head.
Here is Charlemagne, the God of all people, and this should worry Joe Biden to the core. Listen to what he said about that immigration issue. Remember, if we talk about it, Julie, we don't like Hispanics. If we talk about cracking down the wall, we don't believe in the Statue of Liberty. Cut 21.
Like, I honestly have never spoken to as many people who are concerned about the migrant issue as I have, you know, over the past year. They took 2,000 migrants and put them in the school and made the school stay home. Made the students stay home and do school via Zoom, and that was a big issue. I've never seen, you know, working class people who I interact with every day until this past year really, really, really express their frustration.
What does that show you? That guy does an urban morning show, will never vote for Donald Trump, is totally disillusioned with Joe Biden, and that's the reality.
No. Biden is in trouble. I mean, he's in real trouble. I mean, not only is he screwing things up overseas, but really, honestly, the taxpayers here are just fed up. And the immigration crisis is now something that's really pissing off Democrats. Finally.
Did you see there was a stabbing at Randall's Island last night?
Yes!
Yeah.
Like, when did that ever happen before all of these...
These kids used to play sports on those fields.
No, it's awful.
Now it's a tent city.
Every other place that I talk to with other families that still live in the city that didn't get out like I did are, oh, another homeless shelter is opening up down the street. Oh, another hotel is taking on migrants. We're getting bussed thousands and thousands of migrants a day, and the city is going to crap, and there's nothing any Democratic mayor is going to do about it.
Right.
And because comes down to Biden.
And these poor teachers, instead of English as a second language and learning Spanish, it's beyond Spanish. They're coming in with all different languages that they don't even know. So these teachers in these schools are already overtaxed, giving all their attention to legal immigrants, not paying taxes.
What about that school in Brooklyn that actually had to close down for a day and the kids had to do remote learning because they had to fill a gymnasium full of migrants? And then you've got certain Democrats on Twitter who were precious, because I just went nuts over this story, basically saying, oh, what do you expect them to be out in the cold? No, I expect them to stay in freaking Mexico.
Right.
So that's not my problem. You bring your child here, I'm sorry, throw them a blanket. But I have no sympathy for these people.
So right
you
now,
did this to yourself.
And they put them in an airfield.
I'm going to identify as a migrant because I don't want to have to pay for my kids' schooling anymore, and I do not want to pay taxes.
Right, but we're already on the air, and we already called yourself out by
admitting it. Yeah, hopefully the IRS doesn't listen to Fox.
They do.
Okay.
So right now it's snowing, and it might be windy. So does that mean, is it snowing?
I'm going to go to a hotel and get a free room. You want to join me?
Snowing,
I mean,
right?
Not together. That would be inappropriate. But yeah. I think we should go.
You just asked me to go to a hotel room?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I'll see you in HR. But I mean, we could go over to the Ritz-Carlton and be like, book me. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous. The Pennsylvania Hotel and all these beautiful hotels. Like, it's
Terrible. Do you go up to the Ritz? You actually say to the Ritz-Carlton, book me? Or do you say
it
to our travel?
I tell Fox.
Right.
Yeah.
So right now it's snowing. And if it's windy, guess what's going to happen again? They put them in an airfield. It gets windy.
No, it's
so
really
now
bad.
They're going to take the Floyd Bennett School, thousands of people. Do you hear that they don't like the food that we're giving for free? So they're walking around to cars, asking for money, knocking on doors, asking for food.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
They're complaining about the food?
They're throwing
you gotta
it out.
You got to be kidding. Okay, then stop feeding them.
Right.
Stop feeding them.
So
I say tough love for the migrants.
So I know what you thought to yourself. It's bad, and we're New Yorkers, but what about children of Australia? How do they feel? Is that what you were saying to yourself?
No.
Oh. Cut 41.
I don't like hearing you yawn. Because there's a lot of rubbish. You said it's pretty. Oh, there's a little rubbish. rubbish everywhere. Look at all the stuff on the floor. So many people here. Mom, I don't like you all.
Oh, my God.
So what is the background on that, Allison? Because you just told me to play it. I never heard it before, but it's even better than you told me.
I know, right? I mean, you watched the video. Australian mother was walking around with her toddler and filming her toddler talking about the streets of New York. There's a lot of rubbish. It's dirty. The mother said, you're going to go to New York. It's beautiful. You're going to love it. She was not impressed.
Oh, my God. That's really sad.
Right, because
I mean, tourists, and by the way, that's a great example of why tourists aren't even going to want to come in here. Why in the hell would you drive out not only residents and tax-paying Americans out of a city that needs to thrive off of our tax dollars, but you're throwing out tourists. Without tourists, do you remember what happened in New York City after 9/11? The amount of businesses that went out of business and the pandemic? So basically, they're going to turn this into the 80s again, where basically the only job you can get on the street is prostitution.
Right, and they're not hiring right now.
No, they're not. The prostitutes don't even want to work in New York City.
I think prostitution's legal now.
I think.
Do you know, Eric?
Wait, are you kidding me? Why would Brian know this? That's what I want to know.
Right.
Because I did not know this. I know that pot is legal.
Is prostitution legal, Allison? Does anyone know?
I don't know off the top of my head, but you go to Eric first, asking him.
Wow. I'll ask Greg Gutfeld. He'll know.
Right, he would know.
That's he throws you on the bus all the time, so I feel like I have to get
him. I haven't
back.
Heard that at all.
No, not at all. He loves you. Right. Your face is on Gutfeld every single
time. More than even on this show.
No, I think you're actually on that show more than you are Fox and Friends.
Back in a moment.
The 2024 race is on.
We've got our ticket punched out of Iowa.
Iowa made this Republican primary a two-person race.
The latest polls, instant analysis.
I want to congratulate Ron and Nikki for having a good time together.
Next stop, New Hampshire, right here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So you are going to refuse to take my order because my child was screaming?
Yes, I have the right to do that. If you're more than welcome to come inside, or you can place an order online and we'll make it for you.
And what is really, like, you're going to not take my order?
Yes, ma'am, that is what I'm saying.
All right, well, I do have this on video, and I will be emailing corporate because that's just, like, completely rude. I cannot come inside because my daughter does not have shoes on. Do you understand that?
No, I understand, but you're also more than welcome to order through online as well.
So you want me to take an extra 20 minutes and order online? That's not convenient to me. It's your job to take orders and stuff, and this is ridiculous. So I'd like you to take my order, please.
Okay. I will be happy to take your order as long as your daughter's in the stream, all right?
I think that's a pretty good decision on your part.
I don't need this attitude.
Oh, my God. I mean, I hate screaming kids, but that's insane.
So Julie Banderas is here, and that was an example of someone coming up on a drive-thru with a screaming kid at Panera Bread and wanted to place the order. He says, you have to come inside, obviously. So who's right? You should
No. You know what I would have done? I would have gone inside with my kid in their bare feet and just actually triggered her to have a complete mental, like temper tantrum.
So you understand the drive-through guy? What an aggravating job that is, being a drive-through guy at Panera.
Okay, get another job. Like, don't work in the service industry. Too freaking bad. You work at Panera. If you're working in the service industry, you have to understand that there's going to be clients that some. She wasn't even being difficult, and I hate. Like again, I hate the sound of a child screaming, crying, laughing, talking, breathing. But with that said, I mean, I can understand somebody obviously doesn't have kids getting triggered, but you can't do that. That's your job. But that's the problem because he's probably some young, like, I don't know, 20-year-old, has no value whatsoever for, like, job security. He didn't even care when she threatened corporate because that's the sort of mentality that we're raising these days. These, like, entitled brats.
Right. The thing is, what I think got him ultimately the order, the camera.
Yeah. He didn't seem so fazed by it, but he's like, no, if she starts screaming, I'm still not taking your order. He stuck to his guns. He's got head.
He's got, what do you mean?
Head.
What does that mean?
Well, not malls. He's got head. It's my new word for that other word, balls. Okay, go on.
I understood.
Catch up, Brian.
Do you have any idea what you're going to be talking about in that number?
No, I have no idea. Probably 2024 in the election because, you know, we have that coming up. Iowa. Let's talk about New Hampshire.
Real quick, if Nikki Haley does not win New Hampshire or get within 3 of New Hampshire, does she fight on?
I don't think she can. I mean, I think she will, but I don't think she can. I think if Trump takes both Iowa and New Hampshire, it's over. I mean,
even though she's going to South Carolina, where she was governor.
Yeah.
That would be double as embarrassing.
I know, but New Hampshire happens first. And once you lose New Hampshire and Iowa, you're done.
All right. Julie Banderas, thanks so much.
This was fun.
With rollers in your hair.
Heads or tails.
And a chip on your shoulder.
Yep.
We really had a good half hour.
I love you, Brian.
I love you back, but we're not going to the Ritz-Carlton together.
No.
That was just an expression.
No, I'd rather the Plaza.
The Plaza?
The Ritz is crap.
That's true. It's got more history.
Yeah.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. And thanks for being with us all week long. Kind of excited. Fox Nation this weekend, Sunday, 3 o'clock Eastern time, 2 o'clock local time, Joliet, Illinois. I'll be doing talking about the Teddy and Booker T tour on stage. But just talking about winning the war in history. It's going to be patriotic, motivational, inspirational. Watch it on the stream, on the Fox Nation stream. But Saturday night at 9 o'clock Eastern time, One Nation. Got a great lineup that includes Pierce Morgan. Includes Harold Ford, and Joe Concho will be on. And we have Tom Kirstein, too, about your kids and the algorithms that are targeting your kids you might not have any idea about. So we're going to go over some of that, and I think we're going to follow up on the Georgia story where the state case was supposed to put the president in jail. Seems to be blowing up. Before we get to the great Shannon Bream, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Reaction to Netanyahu rejecting a Palestinian state in a post-war scenario for Gaza?
I would just tell you that nothing's changed about President Biden's desire that a two-state solution is really in the best interest of not only the Israeli people, but of course, the Palestinian people.
Yeah, that is Admiral Kirby. All eyes on the Middle East as we are attacking the Houthis daily. Israel is crushing Hamas and being pressured by us to stop. Why both have to continue with an eye on the cause of it all, and that is Iran.
Number two.
Like, I honestly have never spoken to as many people who are concerned about the migrant issue as I have over the past year. Working class people who I interact with every day until this past year really, really, really expressed their frustration.
No escaping the effects of Biden's intentionally broken border. Cities rock, Texas takes over their own border, and criminals running rampant as ICE is forced to look the other way, especially in Boston. Will the Senate plan fix it all? Or not at all.
Number one.
All the polls show Trump with a pretty sizable lead among Republicans. So if Nikki Haley doesn't actually win the New Hampshire primary, that is the state that's probably one of the most favorable states for her on this primary map. And if she can't get a win there, that would be a huge Trump victory and would almost finalize Trump's role as the nominee going into South Carolina.
Josh Krasauer weighing in. More than just the first primary, the New Hampshire showdown is shaping up to be a make or break for Nikki Haley. Why? Super Tuesday is 2 months away, after all. I'll explain as DeSantis holds out for South Carolina, but is not spending any money. And just keep in mind, if you ever leave your family of affiliates, the affiliate you're listening to me right now, you could always listen on the Fox News app. You could watch on Fox Nation, and you could get us on the podcast, your favorite platform. Shannon Bream, anchor of Fox News Sunday. She's also Fox News legal correspondent, and she joins us now. Shannon, welcome back.
Good morning from New Hampshire.
From New Hampshire, you're there already. Tell me what
heck yeah.
So we're going to have a chance to hang out. You could option not to. A lot of people choose not to, and you wouldn't be alone. But we'll have an option to hang out because I'm heading there Sunday.
Well, listen, now that the restraining order is expired,
right.
I think it's time for us to do some in-person radio.
As long as you don't renew it.
Well, it depends on how things go in New Hampshire, so be on your best behavior.
Understood. Remember that hour special you were going to do on me? Did you get that okayed?
It's in the works. Yeah.
We're all of Fox News Sunday.
If you didn't have such, outstanding demands, we would have done it already.
So it's my schedule.
And financial demands.
Right. Okay, that's true. Hey, by the way, Dr. David Agus is coming on a little bit later, author of the Book of Animal Secrets. So I'm just telling that for the audience, not for you, but you might want to listen as well.
Okay. Sounds right. Interesting.
So I want to talk, if I can, about the Georgia situation. So What's salacious and what is matters? So you got the prosecutor who hires what seems to be, she's not denying it, a special prosecutor with very little experience that has been built up, has already built up to $1 million. More than he's getting paid more than the other special prosecutor to investigate the former president of the United States. At which time he's already showed up and twice and billed for meetings with the White House. which is fascinating because they said there's no coordination between the White House in any of these cases. Mm-hmm. So that's out the window. Now the judge wants to see her about ethical violations. Can you give me an understanding of basically what's unethical and what is legally problematic?
Well, I mean, she is responsible for the expenditures of her office. And so if there are allegations that she was doing it in some way to enrich herself, you know, the accusations are that she's in some type of romantic relationship with this attorney that she's hired and they've gone on expensive trips, those kinds of things. That could be a problem if that stuff proves out to be true. But the fact that the judge is having a hearing, I think it's February 15th, they set it for, and apparently it's televised also if the parties, you know, so decide, if people decide to televise it. So we may get a lot of interesting information about Fani Willis, about how her office operated. So the question would really be, did she have any improper use of funds in her office for her own personal benefit?
Right. And you just wonder, too, number one, is it just perception of coordination with the White House? So, if, for example, that's going to help President Trump tell everybody his story's got validity. Mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. But should you be talking to the White House about your case that's supposedly about only about Georgia?
Right. Well, it's interesting because she's been pressed on that so many times. From the first time that we saw her come out and announce the big indictment, it was late at night. She kept getting pressed on these questions. Have you coordinated with the DOJ? Have you worked with the DOJ? So there have been a lot of questions on that. Or is this something that you have used only your state resources to prosecute this Georgia-based case, RICO and all that good stuff under state law? I've never heard her fully answer that question. So it'll be interesting to see what we find out. Again, like you said, if there's billing that connects a meeting with the White House to these efforts in Georgia, I think they're going to have to answer some questions on that front.
So do you think she should be removed or could be removed?
Not for me to decide whether she should, but I think that this fact-finding hearing on February 15th will be really interesting because – listen, it's something that, you know, some of the folks who are at the receiving end of her prosecution say this isn't fair. You know, they flagged it. It'll be interesting to see what the judge determines from her testimony, from whoever else is, you know, called in to testify and give some account to exactly what's happened with the resources. Anything is possible. I mean, if it's found that she has some kind of improper ethical situation going on, and then what does that do to the case? If she's removed as prosecutor, does the rest of the team carry on? Is some of the other rest of the team tainted by this attorney that she's hired that allegedly has a relationship with? All I know is that for the Georgia defendants, all of this could be very good if it delays their case in any way.
Shannon, the other issue was this person, this Nathan Wade, has never tried a felony case.
Mm-hmm.
He's mostly does divorces and accidents. So if it shows that the relationship, which she doesn't deny, and she's at a black church saying that you have to give black women some grace, I don't know what that means. But if this guy is put in that place and a relationship is out there and he's got a divorce coming up and evidently mm-hmm. she wants to depose Fani Willis. So mm-hmm. having all this come up, she was already making a bad choice by picking someone without a background to try a former president in a state court. So in a city district, I'm just wondering right away, is it just bad judgment? It's going to hurt her reelection? Or does the judge look at that and say, that's going to factor in my decision?
Well, I mean, it's not just that he hasn't tried a felony case. You know, these RICO cases are exceptionally complex. There are multiple defendants in this thing. So that would be a lot for anybody to take on. Now, if you don't have the experience in RICO and in prosecuting these big felony cases, it is a very unusual choice that this would be the attorney you would choose and pay all this money to when you're paying other people who apparently have way more experience in this field less money to also be part of the legal team. So I think she's going to have some very tough questions. And listen, the judge gets this. The judge has overseen cases for who knows how long they've been sitting on the bench, but they know what it takes to put these cases together. Now, everybody who's been asked about Nathan Wade says he's a good attorney. He's respected. People think that, you know, he's in good standing in the legal community. But something of this specialty is not something you'd want to do as a first-time case in this field when you're trying, as you said, a former president.
So it's not even the president that challenged this. It's one of the co-defendants mm-hmm. that challenged this. Does the president, should the president, would you recommend if you were working for him, Would it be to his benefit to join this case?
I mean, certainly if there's an opportunity for him to allege or to lodge an ethical complaint, I think this is a good bandwagon for his legal team to get on. They've had a lot of challenges and things have not gone well for them
on any,
in Georgia, yeah. And they're facing some serious issues. So why not cast in with this effort and see what you can get out of it?
Yeah, we'll see where it goes. Right now, the way I understand it, the Alvin Bragg case is probably going to be first. Because after the Super Tuesday, mm-hmm. the date was supposed to be, I believe, was supposed to be the January 6th case by Jack Smith right after Super Tuesday. But now, since they asked the court to rule on whether the president had immunity, mm-hmm. Does that delay everything?
It probably will, because once you know, they had arguments at the appellate level. So this one level below the Supreme Court said, we're not getting involved with it. Let's see what happens in the lower court. They've had their arguments. They could turn that around pretty quickly. So they could even get a decision before February. Now, you can go for the next level before the Supreme Court, that en banc hearing, which is all the judges on that appellate court have to sit and rehear the case. And then you could go to the Supreme Court. So we thought all along the Trump legal team would use every one of those levers to slow this thing down. But right now, it does not look probable that Jack Smith gets his March start date, but it's possible.
Because they keep going up. And then when they say, let's say they just rule against the president, don't have immunity, go up again, don't have immunity. Then does the defense turn around and say, oh, yeah, but now I need some time. I need some time. Or are they expected to have a case ready in case? I know they want a delay. So let's know, having said that.
Right.
So is their case supposed to be ready in case they don't get the judgment?
Well, remember, they've been fighting with the courts about this because it was supposed to pause the case. The district level, which is that first level with Judge Chutkan, when the appellate court started to hear these arguments about immunity, it freezes that lower court's ability, that trial court's ability to handle the case. Technically, it's not their case anymore, so things aren't supposed to proceed. So the special counsel was still doing things, providing documents, all the things you would do in preparation for a trial. And Trump's team went in and said, whoa, 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 this is supposed to be on pause. So it's clear that they want to buy the time. So even if they get a ruling that's adverse to them after all the appeals or whatever it is, they say, now we take the pause button off and now we start over with what was happening at the trial court. Well, special counsel's office is saying, no, we want to keep, you know, the underlying stuff going so that whenever we get to an ultimate decision on immunity, we're ready to go.
And people point out to me how unusual it is for the prosecution to be in a rush. The defense has a mm-hmm. right to a speedy trial. But how right. do you possibly argue that the politics has nothing to do with it when the prosecution's in such a rush to get it done this year?
Well, and the Trump legal team will say, you know, 2-3 years you waited to bring these charges. So why is it now that after 2 or 3 years in which you could have brought a lot of these charges, you finally get them and now you want to speed everything up? So regardless about what you think of the merits of the case, it gives the Trump team and the former president this argument, this ability to say, doesn't this look partisan? And so special counsel is going to have to – they won't come out publicly and discuss it or address it, but they have to know the perception's there.
So I want you to talk about perception again. So Merrick Garland had a presser yesterday mostly about Uvalde, but he had this give and take with Evan Perez. Cut 20.
Some of the polling recently shows that 3/4 of Republicans believe that he's being targeted for political reasons. Does it concern you that that this public perception exists, and what can you do to try to change that?
Okay. Of course, it concerns me. What we have to do is show by the acts that we take that we're following the law, that we're following the facts. The prosecutions that you're talking about were brought last year. And the special prosecutor has said from the beginning that he thinks public interest requires a speedy trial, which I agree with.
You agree with that?
I do. And the matter is now in the hands of the trial judges to determine when the trials will take place.
Okay. He says it's the public that demands a speedy trial.
Well, you know, I guess that's the argument, that they want to know what they're dealing with before they go to the ballot boxes. Primary races or the general election, if President Trump is the GOP nominee. That's been sort of the argument in some of the DOJ documents and things that they've put forward. They say it's of national interest. It needs to be resolved because they want people to know what they're dealing with and who they're voting for. But listen, even if President Trump was convicted on all of this stuff and he was sitting in jail, he'd still run for president. Keep him off the ballot. The one thing that is the potential fight to keep him off the ballot, Supreme Court's going to hear those cases on February 8th about him being kicked off the Colorado ballot and all these other states that are trying to do it by extension. But the fact is, you know, voters will make their decision. I think they know exactly who President Trump is, for better or for worse, whether they love him or hate him. They, you know, there's no mystery to who he is when you go and make a decision at the ballot box.
That is true. Do you know anybody of legal standing that thinks the president's going to get kicked off the Colorado ballot, meaning the other ballots in the other other states that want to do the same thing?
I mean, there are people arguing for it and say that a clear reading of the 14th Amendment says that he should get kicked off. But there are also plenty of people across the ideological left, right, and center who are very respected attorneys who say, you know, I don't think it's going to happen. In fact, you know, there are a lot of us who think there could be a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. That's how tenuous this Colorado decision is. But listen, it's lightning speed that the Supreme Court is hearing this February 8th. For them, that is a rocket, as we like to call it. So I don't think we'll have to wait long to see what they decide.
All right, Shannon, who's on your show?
We have got three members of Congress who are surrogates up here in New Hampshire working it for all these candidates. So we'll talk to them about the campaign trail, but also all of the shenanigans in Washington. J.D. Vance, Senator, is going to be one of the folks with us. Of course, he's a Trump surrogate, and he's also apparently on the short list for VP. Maybe we can get some inside scoop.
All right. I know you can, if anyone can. Shannon Bream, I can't wait to see you in person. I'm going to be wearing a blazer, so you'll be able to recognize me.
Bring a stocking cap also. You'll need that.
Absolutely. It's that cold.
Bring it.
I'm not going to stay outdoors. Shannon, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And watch Fox News Sunday, please. And of course, don't forget Saturday night, One Nation at 9. All right. When we come back, I have some time to squeeze in some calls, go out to St. Louis and go up to the Catskills and more. Then Dr. David Agus joins us, author of a brand new book, The Book of Animal Secrets. Don't move.
Covering this election year like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, guys, let's go right to the phones. Julie, listen on FM News Talk 97.1 in St. Louis. Hey, Julie.
Hey there. I'm going to start with a compliment to you, Brian, and I have 2 points. The first point, thank you. You lead with the most important point in the Fannie Willis matter. Of course, everybody's interested in the affair and all that, but isn't the bigger issue that Biden is lying when he says he is not behind all of these prosecutions and in on it? And isn't that the bigger threat to democracy? Like, Democrats talk about Republicans are a threat to democracy. He's trying to jail his political opponents, and I really hope you stay with that.
I will.
You know, they can replace Bonnie with somebody else. I'm a lawyer, by the way. They can replace her with somebody else, but that case will live on. It's like in a war, the front line goes down, and they get the case to somebody else to fight the battle, and they will get that. There are any number of lawyers who will do that, but please, like, that is just maddening that. And I see so many interviews, and that is what they go to, is the billing and the trips and stuff.
Yeah, it just shows the coordination. But, Julie, you know what I think? They're forcing all these others to cut a deal because you can't afford to defend yourself. They'll go bankrupt. So they're all flipping until they get to Trump. But I don't know what they have on Trump. We all know where he stood.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, right, welcome back, everybody. Dr. David Agus joins us now, author of a brand new book. It's called The Book of Animal Secrets, Nature's Lessons for a Long and Happy Life. He's also the founding director and CEO of the Ellison Institute of Technology, professor of medicine, engineer at the University of Southern California, longtime CBS contributor, and Howard Stern is one of his biggest fans. Dr. Agus, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to see you. A big fan of yours. I've never seen someone so conversational on camera, and I feel like I'm in your office every time I see you. And of course, the way you're able to express complex subjects. I know with this book is long delayed because of the whole plagiarism issue. Your co-writer admitted she did take some of the passages. How did you take action after that came out?
You know, it was a shock to me, right, in that she admitted that she had taken some of the sentences from the book from other places. I rewrote it that night at my own expense. I pulled all of the books that were going to go in the market, and we re-released it with everything corrected. She had done it for dozens of books, and it certainly says something about the publishing industry in today's world where you can check for these things. I'm glad it was caught before the book was released, and I'm proud to have the book out.
Right, and so you went through that. But you still kept your practice the whole time, right? It's not like you were out of work.
No. I mean, I'm still seeing patients. I'm still doing research. You know, luckily, she admitted to doing all of this, you know, on her own, and I knew nothing about it. And the same is true for many other books with other authors. So luckily, the bigger focus of my work, which is helping people, is continuing.
Gotcha. So why did you say to yourself, like, there's clues to our... I guess it's kind of obvious, too, if you do experimental with animals. But there were clues to our existence by studying other animals. That's the real premise of this book, correct?
Yeah, and listen, it's so freaking cool. Is that we've been on this Earth a million years, humans, so have animals, and we've all adapted to the same conditions. So how can we cheat? How can we learn about human health by studying other animals? You know, I was on Africa with our family, which is the coolest trip in the world in safari. And this elephant walks by, and I go to the guide who's taking us and go, listen, they're 50, 60 times bigger than you or I. They're in the sun all day. Elephants must get lots of cancer because the more number of cells, the more chance for mutation and cancer. And he looks at me and goes, no, elephants never get cancer. And all of a sudden, here was a clue. Elephants, even though they have so many cells and all these conditions that could portend to cancer, don't get it. So we started to study each of these and figure out why. And it really was an amazing lesson to me.
So a couple of things. Elephants in the wild, I get it. Untouched by man, I understand it. But when we put them in a controlled environment like a zoo, aren't they susceptible to the same chemicals that we're around that people reportedly say play into some of the health challenges that we all get? So are you telling me the elephants also don't get cancer in captivity?
Yep. You know, listen, these chemicals, right? Egyptian mummies all died of cancer. And so obviously they had different chemicals than we have today, and yet they still had significant cancer. So elephants, you and I have a gene called P53. It's called the guardian of the genome. It corrects error in DNA from inflammation. You and I have one copy. Well, every elephant on every continent has 20 copies of this gene. And why? By the time we hit 20 or 30 as humans, we've had our children. So actually, knocking us off through evolution gave more food and housing to the next generation. Well, elephant females give birth into their late 60s, and the dominant male protects the herd until the day he dies. So they couldn't afford to get cancer, and they evolved away. So all of a sudden, here's a clue that if we can recapitulate, we could prevent all cancer.
So what did you learn from dogs, being that there's so many different breeds? I mean, I have a Great Pyrenees. You might have a bulldog. What do you get from dogs that could help us?
Great Pyrenees are pretty cool dogs, and they actually have a long life, which is very impressive.
Right, for a big dog.
Yeah. All dogs, they sleep all day. And so the reason for that is they don't get deep sleep, REM sleep. If they did, you'd be able to walk right by them and kill the sheep or whatever they were bred to guard. Your first night in a hotel, Brian, you sleep like a dog. Your brain says, I don't recognize these surroundings. And so you don't get deep sleep because you're afraid. It's a mechanism of security. So when I travel, I'm traveling tonight, I'll bring a pillowcase with me for the pillow. I'll use my phone, my iPhone, as a clock before I go. So I have a visual cue, a sensory cue, and a smell cue. So I can feel more like home, and I get better and more deep sleep when I travel.
Do you put that pillow in a bag, or are you one of those people that walk on the plane with the pillow in your arm?
No, I put the pillowcase.
Oh, pillowcase. All right,
Put it on the pillow at the hotel, and I have a little travel pillow I bring sometimes. But no, I don't bring it on the plane. I put it in my little suitcase.
I have seen that. We've all seen that, by the way. So what do you?
I'm not one of them. I promise.
All right. So before I go into other examples, because all this is fascinating. How do you realize this is something we can learn from? For example, people always say, oh, they use mice because they have similar makeups to humans. That's why people always try these different vaccines and medicines and studies on mice. What made you decide where to dig in and where to say, well, this is not going to help us?
You know, the way the book worked is I went to the world's expert in each of these creatures. I sat with Jane Goodall and talked about big apes, and she told me about their parenting and the diet and what we can learn about human parenting. You know, it turns out there are the three types of parents in the ape world, and I met with all the experts. But what's interesting is that they're the parents who said, let the kid do whatever they want. They climb a tree, they fall, they break their arm. Those kids die at a very early age because they took too much risk. They're the parents who never let a kid climb a tree at all, and those kids are always followers and never leaders. And then the parents who out of the corner of their eye follows the tree, once the kid. And once they get a little bit too high, they go and they rescue that kid. And they basically let them fall a couple of times, skin their knees a bunch of times. And those are the kids that become leaders. An amazing lesson for us on parents.
So interesting.
I met the world's leader on ants, on giraffes, on all of these animals. And I say, here are the hallmarks of Alzheimer's, cancer, heart disease, and longevity. What can I learn from your system?
So where'd you go for Alzheimer's advances or insight?
So it turns out dolphins are one of the few creatures on Earth that get something very similar to human Alzheimer's. And so what can we learn from dolphins for humans? Well, one of the things is that when dolphins are part of a pack, even if their brain looks like it's Alzheimer's, they're asymptomatic and they live very well. But once they become loners, not social, the incidence of Alzheimer's goes up significantly. And the same is true in humans, and we really have to focus on that. Being social, connections is important and why we are human and critically important to prevent disease. You know, people with a large social network, it's one of the things that portend for longevity. You know, if you look at the largest study ever done on Alzheimer's, it was every year you delay retirement, you reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's by 3.5 to 4%.
Really? Wow.
And so it doesn't mean you have to do your primary job. You don't have to still host a show. But what you do is you keep your brain active. You don't use it, you lose it.
That's instinctively, I think that's correct. How do you know if a dolphin has Alzheimer's?
You start to see it do erratic behavior, and it's not doing the behavior searching for food and others, and it starts to get very skinny. And then on autopsies, it's got some of the changes in the brain that the human brain has on Alzheimer's.
Understood. A couple more examples. You say rhinos.
Yeah, so the rhinos, it's two very cool things. One is, if you've ever seen a rhino, it is a large animal, yet they don't get arthritis, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. You know, all of us get osteoarthritis, you know, which is the common form of arthritis in our knees, our hips, our fingers, et cetera. Part of it is rhinos only run in straight lines, right? They don't do that zigging and zagging, mainly that we do in common sports where we get our injuries. An important lesson there. But I think the key one to the rhinos is they were trying to breed the rhinos in captivity, and they weren't having any luck. And then started to look at the food they were eating, because rhinos are very large. They need a very large amount of food and expensive. So they were using an inexpensive source of protein, soy protein. And it turns out soy protein is what we call a phytoestrogen. It has properties of the molecule estrogen. So when they change the food from this phytoestrogen soy to another source of protein, all of a sudden the rhinos got pregnant in captivity, and we were able to breed rhinos and bring many of them back from literally near extinction. An important lesson that too much of something is bad, and many things in nature, even though they're coming from a plant, can have properties that are medicinal.
So, Dr. Agus, the book sounds fascinating. It's going to be a huge hit. The Book of Animal Secrets, Nature's Lessons for a Long and Happy Life. Just every page, you learn something. But I just got to ask you, you know, we're trying to figure out what happened with the pandemic. And we know Dr. Fauci's going behind closed doors saying, well, the 3 feet apart, 6 feet apart, we kind of made that up. And masks did or didn't work, or kids really were not affected in retrospect. What questions do you still have about the way we approached the pandemic, from when it hit to the actions we took to the mandates on the vaccines?
So it's not a simple question, right? Is that no question, the first time the public saw the sausage being made in my field, right? Proclamations had to be made based on little data because we had to start to make decisions because there were large numbers of hospitalizations and deaths. And I think it's very important to realize that when a hospital is full, you can be much more stringent in what you do. You have to wear masks. You have to X, Y, and Z with the hope that you can reduce infections than when they're not full. And we didn't take that into account. We are a country that made most of our policy decisions based on a small Middle Eastern country with 6 million people. We had zero data on what was going on in the United States. We got all of our data on the outcomes, on vaccines, on the immune system related to COVID from Israel, which is astonishing if you think of it there. We need to build our data infrastructure. Early on, obviously, there were major mistakes made with testing. And I think that was the beginning of what became us having some of the worst outcome of any country in the world, was because we screwed up testing for 2.5 to 3 months because of a CDC misstep. And I think this is a call to arms that we have to restructure what we're doing in the CDC, restructure what public health is, and really be prepared going forward. There's going to be some blame games because I think some wrong decisions were made. That being said, we have to take some positive from it and learn so this doesn't happen again. If you look at the probability, there is a 32% chance of another pandemic in the next decade. That is not insignificant. And so we have to be prepared so we don't shut down again going forward.
I don't care where you stood. The CDC has lost a lot of credibility with the American public. How do they gain it back?
I think we have to restructure what they do and where they're doing things. First is develop a nationwide data infrastructure program. This idea of states' rights, states can collect their own data, do what they want with it, in today's world doesn't make sense. There needs to be a national level of data so we can know what's happening, and a feedback loop so we could do the right things and know this policy makes no sense or this policy is actually saving lives and stopping the spread of disease. And so there's going to have to be new leadership. And I really think building that infrastructure, it's not expensive, but it really requires us to make a fundamental change because historically each state is responsible for its own public health. And that has to change.
Because people have privacy. So, for example, you know, if you need information from me, from my health in order, people are like, no, I don't think so. I don't want to share maybe what I experienced or any of my personal data. That's privacy is at the hub of what you do, right?
Yeah, you're right, Brian. But if I said to you, Brian, listen, give me all of your credit card data, all of your financial data, and I'll consider you giving you a home mortgage, you say no problem, and you give it to an anonymous person in the bank. If I say I want to use your health data in a privacy-protected way, we have the ability now of literally removing every identifier and being totally protected on your personal privacy and use it for health, you say no way. That attitude has to change, and we need to build the infrastructure to protect privacy and enable the use of data in healthcare because it will be game-changing going forward.
It's explained to me as a non-professional that the mRNA is the what you're using that gives you the most encouragement on cancer, and that was used to design the vaccine. Is that correct?
It's certainly a way that we can improve immune therapy in cancer. And I think going forward, it will be how all vaccines are made. You know, the problem with conventional vaccines is they're very hard to make. Their yield can be small. You can do 100,000 bioreactors. If you ever flow into Newark and you see those big beer tanks making Budweiser, that's how we make conventional vaccines. And you could do an entire couple-month run and get 100 vaccines or 100,000 vaccines. You don't know. mRNA, you program it in, you can get them literally a week later and have it to give to people, and they are safe and they work. So it is going to be a new frontier, and we can use it to actually prime our immune system to attack cancer. And that's what gives us some more excitement also. So this is going to be very exciting going forward to actually stop suffering from disease. At the same time, we have screwed up science trust in our country. And that also needs it. In order to get normative behavior change, which we're going to need in all of this, you need leadership. And so we need a new form of leadership in science.
Is there anybody showing you that they want to be that leader to lace everything back together and regain trust?
Not right now. I think there's a lot of fear of media and other things attacking anybody who becomes a vocal, you know, spokesperson in science. But I think we have to push in that regard. Right. And so we're trying to help as much as we can at the federal level, at the international level, to change that. And I hope it changes.
The Book of Animal Secrets is out. Last question. What do you hope people get from this book?
You know, I think I hope it's optimism, right? Is that hope that we're going to be able to implement some changes soon to really prevent disease. And at the same time, you know, when I wanted a blurb for the back of the book, the publisher gave, get a bunch of them. I texted one person, Jane Goodall, and I said, listen, I want you to blurb this book because it tells people they have to conserve nature and animals. And at the same time, it gives us clues on human health. And she answered me back two words. She goes, hell yes. And, you know, it was very privileged to have that there. But I really want to bring that hope and optimism that there are secrets out there that we can all use today to live a better and longer life.
All right. Go get them. Dr. David Agus, thanks so much. The Book of Animal Secrets is out. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. When we come back, I'll be able to squeeze in some of your calls and get some final thoughts as we get ready for One Nation Saturday at 9 p.m. right here on Fox News Channel.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Don't welcome immigrants if you plan to reject them. If you keep pushing your bigoted HR 2 bill, then also pass this bill. I've taken the liberty of drafting it for you. It removes the Statue of Liberty, our largest symbol that tells people to come here.
How tone deaf is that clown, that congressman from Florida, Max Frost? He actually thinks by saying you have to seal the border and get a hold of 6 million people who came here illegally, you want you to take down the Statue of Liberty? Do you realize where the Statue of Liberty overlooks? Ellis Island. That's where we used to sign the guest book to come here. Remember that. Incredible. By the way, this guy is so lost, he does not understand that even the president knows he's created a catastrophe and has to do something massive. I'm not sure what Senator Lankford and Murphy are working on. I'm not sure what the holdup is. I think they're reluctant to let it out. I'm not sure. Some people said it's sweeping. Other people say it's not enough. But it's substantial because we have to unlock aid, I believe, to Ukraine. We have to unlock aid to Israel. And we got to give Taiwan the weapons they paid for already, don't you think? Meanwhile, quick reminder, Teddy and Booker T, now, thanks to you guys, number 12 overall on the New York Times bestseller list. So great, 6 weeks now. But I'd like to add one other thing. Sunday at 2 o'clock local time, 3 o'clock Eastern time, from Joliet, Illinois. Tickets are still available. VIP opportunities, but on Fox Nation that you're watching me, some of you right now, you'll be able to see a stream. So if you want patriotic, motivational, inspirational, and fun, you'll watch in the afternoon. I hope to hear from you on that. And all my other books are always available to be signed and sent at BrianKilmeade.com. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.